So let's start talking about localized disease. We talked about metastatic disease last Thursday. And we're also going to ask this time, we haven't done this before, we're going to experiment a little bit with live polling just to see if we can make it work. So you see the poll up there. Here's the question for the attendees. Just click on the answer that you think is correct, which was, when was the first checkpoint inhibitor approved for the treatment of lung cancer? It just seems like we've been talking about checkpoint inhibitors, Beth, for ages, for years. There's so much to talk about. Every patient now, first-line therapy in metastatic disease, even small cell, as we have been talking about, is getting checkpoint inhibitors. It seems like it's been around forever. And actually, Beth, the correct answer, believe it or not, is 2015. Any comments, Beth, on what it's been like for you? You've been involved with lung cancer for a while, to see this revolution that came in just really over the last 5 years.
I think it's funny because I would have thought, I knew it wasn't earlier, but because I'd been using them in clinical trials for so long, I was thinking like, man, is it 13 or 12? But I was like, well, maybe it's 16, maybe 15, I don't know. But yeah, I just feel like it's been a long time. And then it was, I mean, just, you know, one got approved, then boom, 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 boom. Right after that, you know, multiple immune checkpoint inhibitors approved in lung cancer and a mainstay of therapy, absolute cornerstone. So
as we were talking about Thursday, there are now only 9 immunotherapy options in the first line approved by the FDA. 9 approved choices. I don't think there's anything in oncology like that. But now we're talking about checkpoint inhibitors for localized disease, and here, chemoradiation, here's the approval we were just talking about. But we want to start out with some cases here today. You know, this is a very rounds-like thing. We're not going to cover everything on lung cancer. We just want to throw out some interesting stuff and keep you awake. So, Liz, let's hear a little bit about this 60-year-old lady and how she presented and kind of what happened with her.
Okay. So this woman in 2 years ago, April 2018, had flu-like symptoms, which ultimately resolved. But she developed a persistent cough that never resolved despite numerous medications over-the-counter and prescription. 8 months later, in December, she was admitted to a hospital due to severe coughing with hemoptysis. And she was found to have a left lung adenocarcinoma, stage 3B, T2B, and 3M0. Her tumor did not express driver mutations. And she went on to receive concurrent chemotherapy and radiation therapy with platinum taxane and radiation. A month later, CT chest, nice response in the left lower lobe tumor, improvement in the adenopathy. And she started durvalumab based on the PACIFIC trial. And here's really what I thought was an interesting issue. After 2 infusions, her cough, which had almost resolved, flared again, prescribed an antibiotic with improvement but no resolution. The oncologist held her durvalumab for 6 weeks, and she came to Houston for a second opinion. Follow-up scans showed small lymph nodes and evolving changes related to previous radiation. And the question was this very quick onset radiation pneumonitis, or was this coughing due to, was this quick immune-related pneumonitis versus radiation pneumonitis, or what else was causing the cough? And we recommended she resume durvalumab, and she's been on it just about a year, and she's had new scans, and she's doing fine. She's back to her active lifestyle.
So, Stephen, we're going to talk a little bit more about, you know, the issue of pneumonitis in this patient. But just sort of taking a step back before we get into that, I'm just kind of curious in general, Stephen, what are some of the things that you think are most important for a patient to know about who's about to begin chemoradiation followed by durvalumab from a patient education perspective, Stephen?
When we start something like chemoradiation, I really have to brace the patient. As a thoracic oncologist, I only treat lung cancer. This is hands down the hardest regimen that I would ever have to deliver. And so I need patients to understand. And if it turns out that they fly through it, which some patients do, they're not going to be upset that I didn't warn them. But if the other sort of outcome ends up, then the patient's really unprepared. So I have to tell them that there's a real chance this could affect swallowing, this could affect breathing, that they could really have a tough time. They might need hydration. Very rarely patients are even hospitalized. I tell them that we're going to push them, and we're not going to push them too far, but we are going to push them. It's a tough treatment. It's a full-time job, and we're really going for cure. So we're really trying to get every dose that we can in.
So I'm curious also in terms of the types of chemotherapy that are used in this situation. I know there's a variation in that. Ben, what kind of chemotherapy are you combining with radiation therapy? And what are some of the other regimens that are being utilized?
Yeah, I think that for years, the standard of care has been the SWOG 50-50 cisatoposide regimen with radiation. And I think we've learned that there are other regimens that are perhaps as efficacious and better tolerated. Weekly carboplatin, I think, is probably the most common regimen that's used. And I tend to use it more commonly now that we have consolidation durvalumab afterwards. I think the hit on weekly carboplatin was, you know, you need to give some consolidation chemo afterwards if you're going to do weekly carboplatin. We don't do that now that we have durvalumab. The other thing that I've been exploring is induction chemotherapy followed by concurrent chemo radiation. So cisplatin pemetrexed 2 cycles followed by concurrent cisplatin pemetrexed with radiation. And we need to remember in the Pacific trial, roughly 25 to 30% of patients did have induction chemo prior to concurrent chemo radiation. Consolidation chemotherapy was not allowed in the trial. So I've done that from time to time as well.
So Liz, how did this lady do during the chemo radiation? What regimen did she get and what kind of tolerability issues came up?
I believe she received carboplatin paclitaxel, and she did very well through it. She did have some dysphagia, which she was warned about. She was able to stay hydrated. She did have some fatigue and cut back on some of her activities, but really did not have any substantial weight loss. She was disappointed when transitioning to durvalumab, her cough flared again, and she was just very, very concerned. But she never had another episode of hemoptysis other than in December 2018. That was her one and only time. No need for hydration, really maintained her nutrition and did surprisingly well through it.
Beth, any comments? Liz mentioned the fact she had trouble swallowing. Of course, a lot of patients can get esophagitis because of the radiation therapy. Any comments on the spectrum of issues that you see in this situation, Beth, in terms of swallowing?
Yeah, I mean, esophagitis is an issue because we do radiation and we cover basically the mediastinum, you know, so there's almost no way to avoid hitting the esophagus. So pretty much every patient's going to have some level of esophagitis, but it varies widely. Some patients eat and drink fine the entire way through with just minimal feeling of esophagitis. Other patients have pretty severe esophagitis. I usually do not have to put a PEG tube in. That is extremely rare, if ever. Usually we can get them through it, even if it means, you know, daily hydration as an outpatient at the end, we can usually get them through it and they start to heal.
So we're going to go through a little bit of the oncology science behind this. We're going to go back and forth between patients and science, but just one more thing about this patient. Liz, anything about taking care of her as a person? You know, we had this theme of why was it different to take care of one patient with compared to another who had the same oncologic situations, but maybe a different person, different attitude, psychosocial situations. Anything that was sort of different about her, Liz? I think, did you mention was she a non-smoker?
She's a non-smoker, and she had a bit of an issue accepting the diagnosis, wrapping her head around it. And we needed to work through that a little bit. But once she accepted, in quotes, her diagnosis, she was a very active participant in her treatment and her care. And so she did everything to the fullest extent of her ability to stay toxicity free. And for the most part, I would say she did it. Some fatigue, but really sailed through quite well.
So let's talk a little bit about localized lung cancer. Unfortunately, most people don't have localized. You see a lot of metastatic disease at presentation. But Ben, can you talk a little bit about sort of how we look at the nodal status, the involvement of nodes in lung cancer, how that affects stage and treatment?
Yeah, node assessment, both clinical by scans and by potential biopsy with EBUS is critical. And this determines potential patients that are resectable versus not resectable, and it determines which patients are candidates for concurrent chemoradiation, 3A and 3B. No regional nodes obviously is the best case scenario, but these ipsilateral nodes that are close to the tumor, peribronchial or hilar lymph nodes are considered N1 nodes. N2 nodes move into the mediastinum or the middle part of the chest. And again, both N1 and N2 nodes can be routinely assessed on many bronchoscopies or EBUSs that are done by the pulmonologist to accurately stage patients. And then N3 would be a supraclavicular above the clavicle or contralateral on the other side of the lung, hilar nodes. And those are critical. I mean, nodal status and understanding what's on a PET scan and also what can be biopsied is critical in determining both stage and how to best treat.
I think it's good to keep this sort of anatomy involved as we start to talk about some of these cases. Stephen, maybe go through a little bit about the staging and how we approach stage 3 disease.
Yeah, so the staging is based on the AJCC-TNM staging system. T is based on the tumor size or degree of invasion into structures like the mediastinum or great vessels. N is lymph nodes, as Dr. Levy outlined. The lymph nodes, it's important, it's a little different from some cancers. It's not the number, it's the location. And so even if you have only one lymph node, but it's in the other side, or if it's, as we mentioned, a supraclavicular lymph node, then that automatically becomes a stage 3 with N3 involvement. And so it's location of lymph nodes, and then M would be the presence or absence of distant metastases. Lymph node status, while PET scans, CT scans, size criteria can really give us a clue, those have to be confirmed, either positives or negatives. And I've seen it go both ways, where we've seen normal-sized lymph nodes, we send them for bronchoscopy, and they end up being positive, and vice versa. I was recently referred a patient with large lymph nodes, referred for a chemoradiation trial. They weren't biopsied, but they were very hot on PET. We sent her for biopsy, and she had undiagnosed sarcoid all through her chest. We took her to surgery, and she had a great outcome.
So speaking of surgery, is surgery utilized, Stephen, in patients with stage 3 disease, and in what situations?
Yeah, so typically, if you know someone right now is a stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer, we would prefer not to send that person to surgery first. Surgery may still be in the cards if we think that cancer is resectable. Most of the data we see for Pacific, as you've mentioned, is for an unresectable stage 3. So before we even go down that route, we have to determine whether this patient is resectable or not. And my team will tell you the only person that can make that call is the surgeon. And so a surgeon needs to be involved up front and say this is resectable or non-resectable. And the patient may be operable or non-operable. We determine that up front. And if we do decide to do surgery, it's not the first thing we do. We begin with systemic therapy and then surgery would be later.
And, here we can take a look at this slide here showing the stage of diagnosis, Beth. And, there were hopes that we were going to shift this down. You can see actually half the patients, maybe even more, present with metastatic disease, almost a quarter stage 3 that we're talking about today. There have been attempts to screen for lung cancer, similar to breast cancer, using imaging. How's that playing out? Do you see many patients diagnosed, Beth, by imaging? And do you think the stage is being shifted by using screening?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, both of the patients that I'm going to present case studies on today were picked up from screening. Now, you'll see that both of them had local recurrence after their surgery, but that's common, unfortunately, in lung cancer. But we do see screening. I think it could be much more utilized, but, that heavily relies on primary care, way before patients get to us. So kind of getting the word out, there's plenty of data to back it up.
So we're going to move in a minute towards these new data that really changed the approach to these patients. But before we get into that, Stephen, maybe you can just talk a little bit about what had been done previously. Because this trial, the Pacific trial, was really a landmark occasion, because there had been so many attempts before that to improve the outcome of these patients, and none of them worked. Can you just kind of talk about some of the things that were looked at that didn't work?
It's very reminiscent of small cell. We were really desperate for something here because maybe even more so, this was a cancer that hadn't spread. which is, as Neil just mentioned, isn't the majority of patients. It's cancer that hasn't spread, is potentially curable, and yet we realize with time we weren't curing very many people. So we always felt that we could do better. And you know, after chemo radiation, when patients recur, the thought is there are still cancer cells remaining that are surviving. Can we use some non-cross-tolerant, can we use some other approach to try to eliminate those? And so one effort was using full-dose chemotherapy. A lot of times during chemo radiation, especially with the carboplatin paclitaxel regimen, we're using lower doses. Some felt you really need full-dose cytotoxic therapy to kill cancer cells. And so we explored induction chemotherapy. We also explored consolidation with docetaxel in different regimens. Those were ineffective, really no impact on survival. We looked at gefitinib in an important SWOG trial. Note that this was not for just EGFR-positive patients. This really was all comers, but that did not provide benefit, even in the subset that did have EGFR mutations. Looking at EGFR monoclonal antibodies, cetuximab, other radiosensitizers, trying to increase the depth of radiation kill, increasing radiosensitizing, simply ineffective. So there are many more trials beyond this where we were trying to improve outcomes. Just every trial failed. This really seemed refractory to any advances we were doing.
So I want to talk a little bit more about the biology of what was intended when we talked about the idea of using a checkpoint inhibitor after chemo radiation therapy. But one other question first for Liz. Actually, we're doing a webinar on July 2nd on COVID and lung cancer. We'll send you a notice about that. But of course, that has been a big topic of conversation. I'm just kind of curious, Liz, at MD Anderson in Houston, how has it affected the management, if at all, of use of chemo radiation durvalumab nowadays or currently with the COVID crisis? I know Houston was not as affected as, you know, for example, New York or Boston, but were you able to continue to use the chemotherapy, bring patients in for chemotherapy, chemo radiation therapy over the last 2 or 3 months?
Well, we were able to continue the concurrent treatment despite the COVID-19 pandemic. We switched to an increased number of telemedicine visits, so the patient stayed away from the hospital, away from clinic as much as possible, but they were able to proceed with their treatments as scheduled. I can't say the COVID-19 has really dramatically impacted or interrupted any of our patients' concurrent treatments, or at least I haven't seen it. Beth, any issues from Penn?
Yeah, I mean, Philadelphia was really a hotspot for COVID. So my first case study that I'll get to this evening, that patient did not come in for her durvalumab for 6 weeks. She was terrified to leave the house. She had severe COPD. She lived in the city where COVID was really rampant. And, you know, I don't blame her. If she would have gotten it, I don't think she would have survived it. Her lung capacity was terrible.
So actually, we'll pick up on that when we get to your case. So just kind of curious what's going on. It's been interesting to ask people about it. Getting back to the biology, though. So, you know, Ben, you know, all this frustration, we tried to increase the dose or all these things, nothing worked. And now the idea of using a checkpoint inhibitor after a chemo radiation. Can you talk a little bit about this, the abscopal effect? It's kind of a controversial thing. Not everybody, yeah, quote, believes that it even exists, but it is a very interesting phenomenon. We don't know whether it's part of the reason that patients did so well with this strategy, but what exactly is the abscopal effect, Ben?
Yeah, the abscopal effect is sort of, it really is a principle which is built upon where these drugs may work. I mean, the whole idea is that radiation may induce tumor antigen release and trigger an adaptive immune response that then subsequently generates memory to go after similar tumor antigens in the body. So by radiating one area, eliciting tumor antigen release, and then subsequently triggering adaptive immune response, that can go after another area. So radiating one spot and then seeing that other spots that were not touched by radiation also regress. And so there's a lot of science behind the idea that chemo radiation, while some have thought it's immunosuppressive, there has been data that by delivering chemoradiation, you are able to induce tumor antigen release. You are able to co-opt the adaptive immune response that then can make these drugs essentially work better or better recognize the tumor as foreign. So this is not a new phenomenon for us. I think there's been a lot of debate as to whether chemo and radiation are immunosuppressive or can trigger an immune response. And I think we've seen, at least based on the abscopal effect, which is controversial, and also on some of this data that we're seeing, obviously, in the Pacific trial, that there may be some synergy with chemo radiation followed by immunotherapy.